inflationary observables into quantum cosmology.
Okay, thanks everybody for coming today. So today I'll talk about some results obtained, next slide, in collaboration with Martin in a paper already in the archive, and with Shinji Tsujikawa in two papers which will be ready soon. Next slide. I will first outline, give a very sketchy review of QC and the effective dynamics in the perturbed Hamiltonian formalism. And then after quickly describing different types of parameterizations, I will go to the main part of the talk where I'll discuss the new results on scalar perturbations, and then collect these results together with the tensor perturbation sector, which was already known for a while, eventually ending up in defining the cosmological observables and placing observational constraints on them. So next slide. Loop quantum cosmology is very interesting because it provides an example of a resolution of the Big Bang singularity problem, which is addressed mainly in three ways. One is at the kinematical level by looking at the spectrum of the inverse volume operator. Another is looking at an exactly solvable quantum model, which is the massless free scalar field. And the third, the Big Bang singularity can be studied and eventually resolved also in the framework of effective dynamics, which is where I will concentrate my talk today. In fact, in the case of effective dynamics in LQC, we know not only the effective equations for a purely homogeneous and isotropic background, but also for a background which is perturbed with linear inhomogeneous perturbations. And the calculation of these effective equations have been done by Martin and his collaborators in the scalar, the tensor, and the vector sector. So all the sectors which are typical also of standard GR. So there are anyway, or at least until some time ago, there were some open issues. One was the role of different parameterization schemes in as far as linear perturbations are concerned. Then it was not clear whether the curvature perturbation was conserved at larger scales. In fact, we didn't even have a Mukhanov equation for scalar perturbations. So we were not able to describe scalar perturbations in terms of just one degree of freedom. And the lack of this equation actually resulted in our ignorance about what happened to the scalar spectrum, the tensor spectrum, and any type of cosmological observable. And so we couldn't even talk about observational constraints. So I will mainly focus on the last four points in this talk. Next slide, please.
Can I have a comment on your slide? Can I ask a question? Sorry? So like in the first point itself, like you're giving an impression that the only the Big Bang singularity has been resolved in the exactly solvable models. But there are many models which are not exactly solvable, which are not massless scalar, in which the Big Bang singularity has been shown to be resolved. So like you're not going to comment on that?
No, I'm not going because I will not deal with the Big Bang problem. So. But anyway, thanks for pointing this out.
And like moreover, like the role of different parameterizations have been already like very well studied in the homogeneous context, and like many parameterizations have been have been heavily constrained, in fact been ruled out. So are you going to comment on that?
Yes, I will comment on the parameterization issue in the case of inhomogeneities. Okay, so We are on the slide, canonical variables and quantization. For a pure FRW flat background, as we know, we use the first order canonical variables, the connection and the triad, which are simplified in this symmetry reduced context to two scalar variables of CNP, which are canonically conjugate, where G is Newton's constant and gamma is the Barberi-Mizzi parameter. Upon quantization, like you see, the densitized triad is promoted to an operator, and well, the connection is not itself a well-defined operator, but instead one takes the holonomy operator, where mu of p is a generic function of a densitized triad, whose particular form we will be not interested here. Now, the classical total Hamiltonian, or the Hamiltonian constraint, then become an operator given in terms of a triad and a holonomy operator, which basically, when acting upon a state in the candidate Hilbert space, will give what basically people call the Wheeler-DeWitt equation in the case of in the case of cosmology. On the other hand, if we take take the expectation value of a Hamiltonian operator between two semi-classical states, we obtain an approximate effective dynamics, which is basically what I'd be interested in today. Next slide, please. There are two types of corrections from this type of quantization, which are very typical of LQC: inverse volume and holonomy corrections. Here, I will concentrate only in inverse volume corrections, and the reason why I do so is that we do not have the holonomy sector under control in the scalar perturbed sector. So this is basically a technical reason. So there is a, I will comment this on the final slide. So ignoring the holonomy corrections, the effective background equations are these, where the first is the Friedman, the first Friedman equation, H is the Hubble parameter in conformal time. The second is the Klein-Gordon equation, and alpha and nu are two quantum corrections, which are of the form 1 plus some quantity, where alpha naught and nu naught are constant, and that delta Planck is some inverse power of the scale factor, where sigma is a constant. Yes?
Is the effective, possibly the effective equation that comes out after quantization?
Yes.
Or is sort of something...
Did you hear the question?
No.
Just repeat it.
So the question was whether these equations stem from the effective dynamics after quantizing the symmetry reduced constraint. The answer is yes. Yes. Okay.
Actually, I would like to comment on your remark that I'm not aware of any calculation in the embedding approach or what Martin has been doing where people have taken inverse scale factor effects and derived effective Hamiltonian. I think it's an assumption. Like it was done very long back in 2001 and so on, where people just replaced the inverse scale factor with some eigenvalues and they just wrote a functional form. But even in the work which Victor has done or the work which Martin has been doing, people have ignored inverse scale factor effects. So I don't think there is any proof that if you include inverse volume corrections, then an effective Hamiltonian follows. The reason is because in these approaches, people have assumed that V is much greater than 1. And if you do that, then inverse scale factor effects just die off.
So by embedding approach, what do you mean?
It's an approach which is based on the geometric formulation of the quantum mechanics. Like I can refer you to the paper by Victor, which, and in fact there was a thesis by Josh Willis, and there was also a paper which Martin, Victor, and Martin, Josh, and Abe were supposed to write. And like lot of later work which Martin has been doing on the states and the fluctuations, like nowhere, like there are inverse volume corrections which have been taken into account from the beginning and an effective Hamiltonian has been derived. So that has been only done using holonomy corrections.
Well, these equations, how these equations are derived, actually, well,
so the way
you do take the Hamiltonian, the symmetry reduced Hamiltonian constraint, and you basically mimic what you do in the full theory. So when you take the EE over square root of a determinant of E piece, then you can you can manipulate it a la Tiemann, you know, as
yeah,
everybody knows.
So the way it is done is that one takes the classical constraint in the of the classical theory, and wherever one sees 1 over A, one replaces by the eigenvalues or which Thomas gave in his QSD papers. Like, that's what one is doing. But one is not deriving this in a rigorous, effective Hamiltonian way. That has been only done for the holonomy correction. So there is actually no proof that these equations will actually follow from any consistent framework.
Well, the assumption is that there is a semi-classical state on which, when calculating the Hamiltonian constraint, you can replace some operators inside the constraint with Rankine values. Yeah, I agree that is a kind of an assumption.
So is the statement now that he's doubting the derivation, or
sorry?
I didn't quite get the point of what he was saying.
He was saying that the derivation of these effective equations, the ground equations, is not completely rigorous.
But that we knew in advance. I've been told many times by Thomas Piemann.
Okay, shall I continue?
If you repeat the remark, we didn't get it.
Okay, I'm told that I have to keep going.
Okay.
So slide strategy, which is the next one. One perturbs the canonical variables, fixing the background to a pure Freeman Robinson Walker. The form of the linear perturbation will depend on the sector one is looking at. In fact, I haven't specified what the delta E and delta K and so on are. One imposes usual canonical relations and eventually writes down the effective constraint, which feature inverse volume functions, which are assumed for technical simplicity to depend on just only on the triad. Here I'm just briefly summarizing some past work. However, when doing so, one realizes that the effective constraint algebra in general is not closed unless one introduces some counter terms. So if we impose the closure of this constraint algebra, we obtain some specific counter terms inside of effective constraints. This has been done by Martin and his collaborators in a series of papers. This anomaly cancellation has been shown only in a regime where the inverse volume corrections are of a form 1 plus something. The case with holonomy corrections is not under control. And that is the reason why I am ignoring a holonomy correction. Basically, because we have the theory under control in all sectors only for inverse volume. Now, next slide. These counter terms depend only on the basically the four parameters of the model. So alpha naught, nu naught, sigma, which are constants, and delta Planck. The specific form is not important here. I just show the counter terms just to give you a flavor of what one has to manipulate. Next slide, please. There is also a consistency condition which relates the three parameters alpha naught, nu naught, and sigma one to the other. So one is not at the liberty of specifying these three parameters independently because of this equation. A very interesting thing is that we did find some background inflationary and et cetera solutions, which exist, however, for values of sigma between 0 and 3. This may be pose some issue about what type of parametrization one uses, so I will very briefly discuss two types of parametrizations in the next couple of slides. But notice that all of the results perturbations will not depend on the value of sigma. So, was there any question? No. Okay.
So, can you please tell us what is sigma?
Sigma is the power. So delta Planck, the correction was something like was proportional to a the scale factor to a minus a sigma. So is the power featuring in the quantum correction. And you can find this in the slide background equation where I defined delta Planck.
So like it was shown like a couple of years back by myself and Alex Corici that for this sigma parameter which you are considering, like anything except sigma equal to 3 does not give you infrared limit or the ultraviolet limit consistently. So why not everything is ruled out according to you?
Say it again.
If sigma is not equal to 3, then it has been shown that the theory does not have a consistent infrared or ultraviolet limit.
Do you mean the issue of the critical density in the bounds, or
no? Critical density is just one of the issues. Like one can look at the expansion parameters, one can look at the infrared limit itself. Like critical density will only become a relevant issue if you are looking at the ultraviolet limit. The theory doesn't even have GR as a classical limit if sigma is not equal to 3.
Okay, well, I will comment on other values from the perspective of a model I'm considering. And in fact, what happens is that there may be problems with sigma large enough, larger or equal to 3. But we can discuss this at the end of the talk if you wish, because anyway, there will be some open issues and there will be room for discussion.
Gianluca, because of my stupidity, we got disconnected for a second. So I have a question, and the question is really the following. I just want to understand the overall logic, and if I'm misunderstanding it, please correct me. So the logic was that one is actually saying that we have constraints of general relativity, and somehow they should be modified by quantum effects. And this is then parameterized by certain functions which sit in the form of the constraint in front of the Hamiltonian densities. Is this right?
They come from pieces which are inside of the Hamiltonian densities.
Right.
And maybe the other equation was a bit misleading. But those functions basically come from the terms featuring inverse volume factors and which we do expect to be characterized by correction functions, just from a general argument. But the assumption there is that this function depends only on the triads and not, for instance, on holonomies. That is a kind of technical assumption. It's not.
But it's an important assumption. I mean, that assumption may be false. That assumption is made just because to make the calculations tractable. I do not see any. I'm asking the question, is there any physical evidence or physical reason why this assumption could be justified?
I'm not sure how to answer your question. I mean, I agree that in principle, it should include also the holonomies. But
it seems to me that there are kind of two assumptions, which we did not even state, namely that these quantum corrections will leave the phase space of general relativity unchanged. That is, we still will have be able to do everything just in terms of trials and connections, or if you like, metrics and extrinsic curvatures. Now,
yes, that is
most
correct.
People would say that if you had a quantum correction, that would add a higher derivative term to the Lagrangian. And as soon as that happens, the phase space of general relativity itself becomes larger. So there is a fundamental assumption here that, in fact, quantum corrections are very clever, very special, very fine-tuned, so that the phase space does not change. And the second assumption is that the corrections are such that they depend only on the triad and not on the connection, or if you like, the metric and not on the extrinsic curvature.
I mean, I didn't say this assumption before. Maybe you missed it because of the line.
Yeah, you did say that. You did the second assumption. But the first assumption.
Yeah, the second one. Yes.
Yeah, the first assumption.
The second.
So it seemed to me that if one gets any conditions at the end, that is as big a doubt on the assumptions that are made in the derivation of the quantum corrected equations as on anything else. In other words, this procedure has two assumptions which were made in order to make calculations tractable. And for the first assumption, in fact, there is a lot of physical evidence, I mean, the general belief, I should say, would say that it is not justified. So I just would like to keep the perspective clear when you say things like something is inconsistent. The things that could be inconsistent could just be the basic assumptions, the basic premise with which the analysis began. Is this incorrect?
No, I agree with you.
Okay, thank you.
Actually, I would like to make another remark based on the remark which Abhay has made. Regarding the second assumption, like I did some work with Gonzalo a couple of years back, and I think that it indicates that even the second assumption may not hold in loop quantum cosmology. Like, of course, like it is just a work based on the isotropic model with a massless scalar field, but even there one sees a clear evidence that the second assumption which Gianluca is making may not hold in quantum gravity. Thank you.
Okay, let's go back to the slide, to the next slide.
Gianluca, can you just make a quick comment? Since
these
questions were really about some other papers that you're not talking about. So about the connection dependence, one can interpret these counter terms, some of them at least, as introducing an additional connection dependence, which is not included in our original assumption. So by imposing consistency, the framework forces us to introduce connection dependence, even though we don't know it initially because we haven't derived it yet. But it is included once consistency is imposed. The question about extra degrees of freedom, they do arise, but they come from other corrections. So inverse triad corrections come from quantum geometry, not from the quantum dynamics directly. And it's the quantum dynamics that introduces from quantum back reaction, those additional degrees of freedom. So there's certainly evidence that these degrees of freedom arise, but there's no evidence that they have to arise directly from inverse triad corrections. It's true that we ignore these other corrections, so we don't have a fully corrected effective Hamiltonian that has all the terms in it, but at least we can probe one crucial correction that comes from the full theory.
Right. So I just to continue this conversation, the only reason I'm continuing it is because one is drawing conclusions at the end, and I would like in the conclusions that are drawn at the end to have all assumptions that are made in the analysis which leads to these conclusions. So just now, Martin just explained to us that because of inverse triad corrections and so on, there are extra degrees of freedom. But these extra degrees of freedom are not the kind that would happen, which would actually enlarge the phase space itself. The functions that are written down are functions on the phase space comprising of triads and connections. Whereas if you had a higher derivative correction, which is what most people would say there should be because of quantum gravity, if you just write down, for example, the all possible counter terms in the action, etc., etc., those will actually enlarge the phase space. And this is ruled out by step number one itself in this analysis. And indeed, even if you begin just by saying that all the correcting terms should just depend on the triad, the consistency might force you to add some terms which will depend on the connections. But that is very different from starting the analysis in which you allow all corrections to depend on all phase space variables and then see what one gets. Again, I want to emphasize that this kind of analysis is extremely helpful and useful to get us a feel for what is possible, what is not possible. But I just want to draw kind of a little caution in when one actually makes broad conclusions based on such analysis, and in the final step, ignores the assumptions that were made. Thank you.
Okay, anyway, I wish to stress that if you're interested in a detailed discussion of the assumptions we've done in these calculations, you can look at the papers. Of course, in the talk, it's necessary to simplify the presentation, but if there are other questions about assumptions, they might also come out during the talk. Now,
which slide are you on now?
I'm on the slide mini superspace fiducia volume problem.
Okay.
Okay, so when one deals with spatial slices with the infinite volume, it is necessary to remove this divergence from the from the Hamiltonian analysis. And to do so, one typically introduces a finite fiducial volume. The problem is that this volume is mathematically arbitrary, so it shouldn't feature in a physical observable. However, it does because in the quantum correction, it naturally appears. So, in particular, one might be tempted to say that in this type of parametrization, where the quantum correction delta Planck goes as some inverse power of the fiducial volume, one would be tempted to say that these quantum corrections, which appear in observables, would feature the fiducial volume. Now, still in this parametrization, the constants alpha naught and nu naught can be calculated. They depend on some ambiguities in the constraints, and a natural choice, often called improved quantization, is that of sigma equal to 6, which gives some particular values for alpha naught and nu naught when one fixes the ambiguities at some natural values. So when I talk about the mini superspace parametrization, I basically mean sigma equal to 6. The other parametrization I will briefly talk about is called the lattice refinement, which basically replaces the volume of the fiducial volume inside the quantum correction with the patch volume, which is basically given by which is a smaller volume, which makes sense only in the presence of inhomogeneities. In that case, one divides the fiducial volume in a number of cells. This number is phenomenologically dynamical, meaning that it varies with time. And there are some simpler arguments requiring what type of evolution of this number of cells could follow. And here, the scale factor is used as basically as a time variable describing this type of phenomenological behavior. In that case, the quantum correction is still of a form of a to the minus a sigma, but this sigma now, rather than being fixed by several arguments to the number 6, as in the mini superspace parametrization, here is basically required to be non-negative. Also, there is the constants alpha naught and nu naught are not do not stem from any calculation like in the mini superspace approach, but calculation on inverse volume operators and spectra show that basically these corrections should approach the classical value from above, meaning that these two constants are non-negative. So by lattice refinement parametrization, basically I mean sigma non-negative and alpha naught and nu naught non-negative. Next slide, please. Now, we introduce, so since we are interested in inflation for in this IQC effective dynamics, we introduce these lower parameters as defined exactly as in standard GR. But in general, one can express them in a more explicit form, and one will see the intervention of the quantum correction via the background equations of motion. In particular, their time derivative in general will feature again the quantum correction. Next slide. So the status until now of scalar perturbations was the determination of the following equations. So we have two gauge invariants of scalar modes, capital C and capital C, which are basically the 0-0 and the spatial-spatial diagonal perturbations of the metric. They are relating one to the other by the first by the relation in the first line. Then we have a diffeomorphism constraint. Then we have an equation on motion for the quantity psi, where in blue you can see the new terms coming from the quantum correction. So basically, this is stemmed from the quantum terms. Here I do not define what f naught and mu psi are, but they are just the functions of sigma, alpha naught, and nu naught. On the other hand, an important correction here is also on the propagation speed of this scalar mode, which is squared, is S squared, where chi is, again, a constant depending on the parameters of the mode. Finally, we had a perturbed equation for the scalar field, where, again, there are some quantum corrections, which, again, I do not define here, but they're just functions of these three parameters. Next slide. A natural question is to ask whether the curvature perturbation is conserved. So the gauge invariance of curvature perturbation is the one you see in this slide. And in the second line, you can see the extra piece which makes the difference with respect to the curvature perturbation in standard GR. It is not obvious that this quantity is conserved because we have a deformed constrained algebra, and in particular, this might lead to deviation from the usual conservation law. And if this was the case, then we would have important modifications on our physical understanding of inflation spectra. So a first check is to see whether R, capital R, is conserved. Next slide. So a direct calculation shows that the time derivative of R is as in the first line, where the first term is a gradient of capital C, and the second term is proportional to the perturbation of a scalar field. But the coefficient in front of this term, which is written explicitly in the first line, where C is equal to h squared over phi prime, etc., is actually zero by virtue of the anomaly cancellation condition. So after replacing all of the counter terms S of 1, etc., in that expression, we obtain identically zero. This is a dedicated cancellation only possible for because of the anomaly cancellation condition. So to summarize, the last line tells us that at the largest case, where gradient terms can be neglected, the curvature perturbation, the gauge invariant curvature perturbation, is still conserved. So this is one of the main results. I wanted to talk to you today. Next slide, please. This also tells us implicitly that there does exist a Mukhanov equation in closed form, which is not altogether obvious a priori. So if one defines the Mukhanov variable as in the first line, where z is a specific function of the background quantities and the quantum correction, one can show in two ways, one very long and one very short, that the Mukhanov equation is as in the red box. It is a very simple result in closed form. Closed form meaning that it entails only the Mukhanov variable u and not the gauge invariant filler perturbations separately. This is expected actually from other considerations which makes use of the Hamilton-Jacobi method developed in the early 90s. And the main reason why we can get this simple Mukhanov equation is that the reduced phase space is has the same number of degrees of freedom as in standard GR. The fact that it is very simple is because of the conservation of the curvature perturbation. Now, one issue one could look at is whether, so this Mukhanov equation is the only thing we need to fully describe the scalar sector. So we might ask whether these scalar modes propagate with superluminal speed. And this happens if one looks at what was S and what was alpha. This happens only if sigma is greater or equal to 6 for positive alpha naught and mu naught. Now, this may be a problem or maybe not. I do not have a precise judgment over this result because there do exist models in cosmology where inflationary modes propagate superluminally, but they are not associated with any physical inconsistency. On the other hand, one might argue that this issue may affect modes which are quasi-classical, and so it might give rise to macroscopical instabilities. I just wanted to point out this parameter range for this issue, and move on to the next slide. Once we have the Mukhanov equation, we can solve it exactly, but it's not very instructive to do so, so I'll just discuss the asymptotic solution. The first step is to choose a background, in particular a power law background, which mimics inflationary backgrounds or even the system backgrounds. The horizon crossing, that is the moment where a perturbation mode exits or enters the horizon, is defined as in the second line, as in standard GR. And so after these premises, we can directly look at a small scale and larger scale solutions. So the solution when the wave number k is much larger than the Hubble parameter, so modes well inside the horizon, is given by a plane wave plus something proportional to the quantum correction. On the other hand, at the larger scale, by just looking at the Mukhanov equation and dropping out the k-squared terms, one realizes that the function u is just proportional to z, and the coefficient of proportionality is given by the matching condition with the solution at the scale. So this is a standard procedure motivated from standard inflation, which gives this result. Now, what we are interested in is the larger scale solution, because that enters the definition of the scalar spectrum in the next slide, which is basically the modulus squared of a larger scale solution, but evaluated at horizon crossing. At the end of the day, the result is the right most hand side of the first line, where the ordinary scalar spectrum is corrected by the delta Planck term, where gamma s is a coefficient which depends on the parameters alpha naught, nu naught, and sigma. I remind you that the key is in turn a function of these parameters. And since the scale factor at horizon crossing is proportional to the wave number, the quantum correction case as k to the minus sigma. So since the sigma is positive in both our parameterizations, this implies an enhancement of power at larger scales, meaning small k. Then we define the scalar spectral index as usual. And again, we have the standard part, which is the first order in the slower parameters, plus a quantum correction whose coefficient you can see in the last line. Next slide, please. This is a picture of a power spectrum as a function of the wave number for different values of the quantum correction delta. So the straight line, I cannot see the lines very well, but if you do, anyway, the bottom line, the straight line, is the one with no delta, no quantum correction. So that is the standard spectrum, which reproduces the quasi-scaling value. However, if you switch on the quantum correction, you will see then the enhancement at small scale, at larger scale, which we just argued to be present in the former slide. If so, this is plotted for sigma equal to 2. If you increase the value of sigma, basically you push the enhancement to your left, meaning that this enhancement is visible only at very, very low multiples. So by low multiples, I mean L equal to 2 and 3. At this case, cosmic variance is completely dominant. So this means that from the observational point of view, larger values of sigma would not give rise to an appreciable signal, an appreciable signal from this type of physics. Next slide, please.
Can I just ask a question about your graph here? So,
yes.
As you said, that the effect is really significant only for large scales or low Ls. So, but there are huge error bars there, right, in the low Ls for the quadruple. I mean, dipole is anyway not observable. So the quadruple, so for the quadruple, there's a big error bar. So I would think that these error bars actually, I don't know the scales here. So are these plots that you are drawn, are they the dotted plot and the solid line plot with the corrections? Are they within the error bars?
No, there are no error bars. No, what I wanted to say is that for a large enough sigma, the enhancement at the largest case would be at the two largest case. So in that case, the cosmic variance would dominate. So we couldn't trust any type. I mean, we couldn't really detect robustly any type of enhancement in that case. However, if a sigma is small enough, for instance, this sigma equal to 2 is a good example.
Yeah.
This enhancement happens also at multiples of order 10. In that case, the cosmic variance is small enough to make the detection robust.
Okay. The second question is really that all this is happening during inflation, right?
Yes.
It is not. Now, during inflation, the matter densities are some 10 to the minus 11, 10 to the minus 13 Planck densities. So anybody would think that that's what cosmologists always say, that any Planck quantum correction, which is coming from Planck scale physics, would be enormously suppressed. And if one actually does put formulae in, for example, the work that Barrow and et al. Have, Grain, Barrow et al. Have done in the French group, one sees that these quantum gravity corrections, particularly the ones coming from universe scale factor and so on, they're suppressed by a factor of 10 to the minus 10. It's basically the Hubble parameter squared upon the Planck scale squared. And so here, what I'm not understanding is that why does one expect that if in fact quantum gravity corrections are already observable at this scale, then they would not have many other effects as well. You know what I'm trying to say? I'm trying to say that normally one says that quantum gravity effects are going to be suppressed by, for example, Hubble squared upon Planck scale squared. And that
is true. Excuse me. Sorry to interrupt you. That is true only for models where you consider higher order curvature corrections. Are you referring to both?
No, the LQC corrections, they're just inverse scale corrections and the holonomy corrections that these people have looked at, the French group has looked at. There, the corrections are always of the type, the Hubble parameter squared upon divided by the Planck scale squared. And that is always of the order of 10 to the minus 10 or smaller.
And you're referring to the holonomy corrections?
No, also inverse scale.
Inverse scale.
In other words, what I'm saying is that maybe the factors of delta that you're writing down, you're just choosing them, just trying out some values, right? And I'm saying that those values the realistic values for them, may be of the order of 10 to the minus 10, in which case these corrections would not be actually visible.
Okay, this plot is just, in this plot, I just put by hand values of delta.
Yeah, and my point is that if you look at physically realistic values, which are actually allowed, so that you don't run into trouble with, physics at a later scale, not only at gut scale, but even at later scale, the values of this delta parameter might be much smaller, right?
Yeah, but my goal here is to place upper bounds on delta, which I'm going to do in the next slide. So the question now is, what is the maximum value of delta which is allowed just by observations?
Thank you.
Also, letting us out, of course, there may be theoretical considerations arguing for one order of magnitude instead of another. But here the point is to place an observation upper bound, which, of course, may be much larger than what could be actually be.
Thank you.
Okay. So now we are in the next slide, scalar running. And this is the expression for the running of the scalar index, which is its variation with respect to the wave number. And again, the first part is the second order inverse row parameters, and it's the standard running. The second part features the quantum correction. And the interesting thing is here that this quantum, this extra part, this new part, is large enough, it could dominate also over the order epsilon squared term. This suggests that the upper bound on delta on the quantum correction should probably come, and actually it will come, from the observational bounds on the scalar running. So basically what one can argue just from this equation, and this is actually what we get from the numerical analysis. Next slide, please. So before going to that, let me conclude the analytic part and briefly remind what happens in the tensor sector. In that case, the equation of motion for the tensor mode was found a couple of years ago, and defining the Mukhanov variable W as in the second line, where alpha tilde is the scale factor times 1 plus correction, one gets the Mukhanov equation, which is formally identical to the scalar Mukhanov equation, up to a couple of trivial substitutions. So we have already solved this equation, so we can show the results which are obtained almost for free in the next slide. So the tensor spectrum, again, has a quantum correction. Of course, now the coefficients of numerical, the parameter-dependent coefficients are different. But again, one can define consistently the tensor index and the tensor running. Finally, next slide, the ratio of a tensor to the scalar power spectra give the tensor to scalar ratio small r, which can be combined into a consistency relation featuring only physical observables. This consistency relation typically enters the numerical codes when computing the CMB spectrum. And as you can see, the usual consistency relation is only the first term of the box equation. And the last term is, again, the quantum correction. Now, next slide. The idea is first to recast all these observables in terms of the inflaton potential. After that, excuse me, after that, one can choose a set of values in the parameter space, for instance, the shape of the potential or the value of sigma. And after choosing these parameters, one can perform a likelihood analysis and eventually find upper bounds for the quantum correction. So this is the idea. Next slide. Here we define the slow parameters in terms of the inflaton potential. There are relations between these parameters and both I showed you during the talk. I won't show you these relations because they're long and uninstructive. But anyway, one can recast all the observables in terms of these new quantities. And in particular, for a power law potential, as you see in the last line, the first row parameters are all proportional to epsilon. So this reduces reduces our parameter space, and in particular, we have only to deal with epsilon. Now, I'll fix n equal to 2, so I will consider only a quadratic potential now. We are doing the analysis also for a quartic potential, but I do not have those results yet. So now I will discuss only what happens for a quadratic potential. So next slide. For fixed values of n and sigma, all of the observables given above, so in particular the scalar running, the scalar index and its running, are, can be written in terms of two parameters, epsilon and the delta. This delta is the delta Planck times alpha naught. The reason why I do not consider nu naught is because of the consistency condition we've seen a few slides ago, which related the three parameters of the theory. So basically, one is always able to find out that combination. And unless the sigma is equal to 3, but this issue is not really important. So anyway, we are left with only two parameters which we want to constrain. And we just saw with a marginalized likelihood analysis using the Cosmo Monte Carlo code and the several data sets, we take the WMAP7 release plus the baryon acoustic oscillation data set and that coming from the Hubble Space Telescope. We have checked that using different data sets, we get very similar results. So we use this data set because it is also the one used by the WMAP team and claimed to give the tightest constraints on the parameter space. Next slide, please. So here we see a plot for the quadratic potential and sigma equal to 1. So the two curves are the one sigma and two sigma contours. And as you can see, delta is somewhat smaller than 0.04. In the next slide, we discuss this picture. So basically, these are the upper bounds at the two sigma level. One notice is that the quantum correction is not negligible in the scalar index because it is of the same order of the slower parameter. This may suggest that actually second-order observables, like the running, might be affected by terms order of delta squared. But we do not know this term. So this means that this case is only marginally trustable, considering all the approximations and assumptions in the, basically, considering all the truncation schemes we adopted in finding the cosmological observable. So sigma equal to 1 is kind of a marginal interest because of this reason. So let's go to sigma equal to 2, and this is the plot. As you can see in the vertical axis, the order of magnitude now is much smaller. And in fact, in the next slide, we see that the upper bound is something like 10 to the minus 4, which is much smaller than epsilon. This is definitely consistent with the slower expansion and with the delta expansion. So this value is kind of more trustable than the other. Furthermore, theoretically, epsilon for an appropriate number of refoldings is between 0.008 and 0.011. So if you look again at the picture, you see that this strip lies within within the two sigma bound, meaning that the quadratic potential is compatible with observations, which is also true in the standard case. If you choose larger values of sigma, which you do not show here, basically one will get even tighter bounds on delta, meaning that if any, this inverse volume effect will be practically unobservable, which is also consistent with the power law enhancement at the two largest case, which I commented on a while back. So let me skip the next slide and go directly to the open issues slide, which are many. One is that the anomaly cancellation has been verified only for linear perturbations and for inverse volume correction. So Halonic corrections should be implemented. And the question also arises whether this anomaly cancellation is consistent at higher orders. Because it might happen, we do not know, but it might happen in principle that we get an over-constraint on the parameter space. And this thing should be checked, but at least at the linear level, seems to work. There is that issue of super luminal propagation, which should be thought of a bit more. Then there may be the possibility to combine these cosmological observations with other observations coming from astroparticle physics, because these inverse volume corrections are expected to affect these dispersion relations of waves propagating in a quantum space-time. So in general, there might be other experiments which would place independent constraints from different from those I showed you today. And finally, well, the analysis can be carried out for various potentials and values of the parameters, but this is a story in progress, and so I will stop here for today. Thank you.
questions.
So, Gianluca, I'm trying to understand the way that you did analysis, the part which has to do with scalar and tensor perturbations. Now,
you mean
normally,
the analytic analysis?
The analytic analysis, right, exactly. So
okay.
Now, what I'm confused about was that, on the one hand, you're saying that there are actually corrections to the wave equation, and they may be superluminal propagation and so on. Right?
Depending on the value of the parameters, yes.
Yes. So, in the parameters that you considered, I mean, even if you don't sort of worry about superluminal corrections, you're not going to, I mean, the equations were corrected, right? They were not the standard equations for perturbations.
Yes.
So, now normally, one starts out this analysis by looking at the standard wave equations, you know, not the wave, but you know what I mean, the wave-like equation, the standard equation for perturbations. And then one makes all these arguments about doing quantum field theory in curved space-times. And then one says that, well, at somewhere at the onset of inflation, the relevant modes are all in the Bunch-Davies vacuum, and that is all justified because of the equation that is satisfied by these modes. And then one proceeds from that.
It is partly justified by that.
But your equations are different. So what analysis in quantum field theory in curved space-time did you do? And what was the justification for choosing whatever the initial state you chose, and what was the initial state that you chose?
Yeah. So the idea is that when you switch off the quantum correction, you recover the Bunch-Davies vacuum, so an incoming plane wave. If you fix... If you start from this point, then everything basically follows naturally. By this I mean that since all the analysis is linear at the level of a quantum correction delta, I can certainly choose an answer for the solution of my Mukhanov equation as being some A plus something proportional to delta. So I have a classical part, a standard part, plus a quantum correction. This type of expansion can be done because of the Mukhanov equation itself is can be decomposed into a let me call it classical part plus a quantum correction part. This type Now, if you fix the classical part, in fact, by saying, okay, I want to have a plane wave at most case, et cetera, then the rest is determined by your equation of motion. It is exactly the same thing that happens in stochastic inflation, where you basically have a noise source, which... allows you to define your solution as some leading order part, you know, plus some correction. And so when you decouple the Mukhanov equation, you get the classical equation, that's okay. But then you get the quantum equation, which is similar to the classical equation, plus a source term depending on the leading order variables. Now, the fact that the source term is fixed because you have fixed the leading order variables, fixes also the next two leading order parts. So basically that is what we did.
But still I'm not clear about what the choice of the state was. What you just told me was just how you solve the equation, your equation, starting with Mukhanov equation, right? I mean, given a solution of the Mukhanov equation, you're saying that there is some procedure by which you can get a solution to your equation. That's what I understood. But there is more physics than just getting solutions, right? I mean, namely, choice of the state.
I agree. I agree, but we have not considered all these physics in detail. So certainly there, people should think more about that.
Okay.
I mean, what I said, I just reported, I mean, it is a technical argument, but it relies on the fact that we know, or at least we presume we know, what the solution should be at the classical level. And that's, and because of the quantum correction is assumed to be small from the very beginning, this actually fixes also the next two leading terms. So the issue instead of what is the vacuum with which you consider your deformed field theory, et cetera, et cetera, yeah, that is an open issue. So I do not have
yeah, no, I understand. So it's a very interesting issue, but so of course one cannot solve every problem right in the beginning. But it's also an interesting issue because even your background is not the same as what people would assume, right? The background space-time is also quantum corrected. Is that correct? I mean,
you mean the background,
yeah.
The solutions of the, well, yes, because the
yeah.
Effective equations are, yes, contain
right.
the corrections, yes.
Okay. Yeah, question. Yeah. Okay. Here is another remark from her.
Hi. I want to further comment in the point that Alai was raising before, and give the following point. In general, what you did in general is to consider quantum corrections, in particular to consider inverse volume corrections and neglect for the moment Holonomy correction, and you obtain the equations for the background with quantum corrections, and what is even more important, the corrections for the scalar and tensor perturbations, including these quantum corrections. And then from these quantum corrected equations, Mukhanov equations, you recompute the predictions of inflation for the spectrum of scalar and tensor perturbations that we eventually observe in the CMB. So as I pointed out, naively, one expects that because this process of the creation of perturbations during inflation happens at an energy scale, which is, roughly speaking, 10 to the minus 10 times the Planck scale, one naively thinks that quantum corrections at that level are going to be totally negligible, or at least suppressed by this 10 to the minus 10 factor. So if one expects corrections coming from quantum gravity, it's because in the model, there is some kind of mechanism or ingredient that is able to amplify these quantum corrections. My question is, could you more explain about what do you think is this mechanism or is this mechanism or ingredient in the model that is able to amplify these quantum corrections?
Well, one reason why this type of quantum corrections might be sizable is that what changes here is the structure itself of space-time. This means that, for instance, also the concept of a gauge invariance is deformed from the very beginning because of the constraint algebra is deformed. So I think this structural difference could, in principle, justify the hope that inverse volume corrections, or in general, corrections in quantum corrections in low quantum cosmology, or maybe low quantum gravity, might be more sizable than expected. But I'm not sure whether this answers your question. This is just a tentative.
I would like to make a small remark, like it goes back to the comment which Abhay made some time back, and it's related to this remark, which is this comment which is going on. Like, I think the main point is that if the inverse scale factor corrections are, like, if you think they are going to be important during the regime where the space-time curvature may be 10 to the power minus 12 or 10 to the power minus 16 of the Planck curvature, aren't you telling us that the inverse scale factor corrections actually are incompatible with the classical space-time and you do not get the right infrared limit?
I don't get your comment. Can you try to explain it differently?
Like the other way to look at it is that, like, can you relate using inverse scale factor corrections only in your modified Hamiltonian, which you assume? What is the value of the scale factor at which the space-time curvature will have a particular value? What I want to say is that with inverse scale factor effects, you cannot tell us that at this scale factor my space-time curvature will be this much and I will have this much, I will be this much away from the Planck density. I think that is why there is all this confusion. You can do that in a closed model, where it is spatially closed, where inverse scale factor has a well-defined meaning in terms of the actual physical radius of the universe, and it measures the effect of the intrinsic curvature of the space-time. There you can relate that. But in the flat space-time, what you're doing, you cannot do that.
In fact, I never said that I measure scale factor.
No, I'm not. I'm not saying that you said that you measure scale factor. What I'm saying is that you cannot relate any energy density with the scale factor in this model. And that is why you cannot tell, and that is why you do not have any control on how big your corrections are, even when inflation is going on.
Well, I totally agree that there is no control over what the quantum correction is in the detail, because it's... We lack an input from the full theory. So if we had the time, the state of the universe saying, okay, we should have this number of density, number of vertices per unit volume, etc., then we could work over the details. In fact,
I would disagree. I don't think like one can just put everything under the carpet and say like full theory will answer that. Like one can just look at the homogeneous. One can just look at the homogeneous model.
I am sorry to interrupt you, Param, but placing an upper bound on a free parameter of a model is not putting things under the carpet. It's something which is very common. In fact, that's not much, I believe, we can do observationally from this with this type of model. We can just place upper bound.
I think like it's a very useful exercise that one assumes in general, like, okay, like let us assume that these are the parameters which are there coming, which may come from full theory, and one should certainly place upper bounds on that. But what I'm just asking is that what I was just trying to comment on was your comment that like we have to wait for the full theory to answer this question. To that I disagree. Like one can just take the homogeneous background which you are having, on which you are doing inhomogeneities, and one can answer these questions, and then you will find that you cannot associate any space-time curvature with your whatever is your A Planck or anything, and one will see like if you need to have the right infrared limit, then your corrections are going to be completely suppressed. I don't think one needs full theory for that.
Okay, well, if you can do this only in the purely homogeneous and isotropic case, then I think we could argue a lot about this. But if your statement is also pertains a context where homogeneities are taken into account, then I agree. So are you talking about a purely homogeneous and isotropic result, or one with inhomogeneity?
No, the point of getting the right infrared limit with the inverse scale factor effects is both with the homogeneous and the inhomogeneous situations. Like,
okay.
And you can repeat this exercise in both the cases.
Okay.
I don't think that there is disagreement between the two of you, right? I mean, I think you are saying, I think that Gianluca is saying that, we make some assumptions about what kind of quantum corrections they could be. I mean, and these are not justified from some big principles or anything, but this is what we try. We get a self-consistent scheme, which to the first order in the perturbations and first order in quantum effects is actually gives you a closed algebra, and then one just sees the interesting thing to see what its ramifications are. There are free parameters that one tries to constrain by looking at the data. I think Param's point of view is that, I guess more standard cosmological point of view. I mean, if you say something like this to the cosmologist, that there are quantum corrections during inflation, they're typically going to be skeptical, that because during inflation itself, not from coming from some era before inflation, but just during inflation itself. That got you skeptical precisely because the density is the, our curvature or density is 10 to the minus 10 to 20 to the minus 12 times the Planck density or curvature. And so they're going to say, what is the mechanism, as I think Ivan was saying, which raises this. And I think Gianluca is saying that that's a good question, and one should either look for the mechanism or one should actually write down in some detail an argument which says that even with these inhomogeneities, if in fact the parameters are such that we have observable effects, quantum effects during inflation, then maybe one can rule out the theory on the basis that it does not have direct infrared limit. Somebody has to do this work in detail. Am I summarizing it okay, Gianluca and Parab?
Yeah, I mean, if it could be done without, evoking proof theory, that would be great. Of course, I agree.
I think I would agree with you on broad level. Thank you.
More questions?
Can I just add a quick comment about all these questions? The usual expectation about observational effects during inflation doesn't fully apply here because it's based on higher curvature effective actions. That's why everybody expects it's related to curvature of the density in some way. Now, all higher curvature effective actions would produce the classical algebra of constraints, while in this case of corrections, the algebra is deformed. So it's clearly a different situation, and we cannot directly apply that intuition. That doesn't mean that corrections have to be large, but it means that we have to reanalyze the situation. We cannot directly apply standard intuition, and we just have to see what we get.
Yeah, I think I agree with that, but I mean, there's also deformation of kind of equations in non-commutative geometry, for example. There also people don't expect corrections to be significant if, in fact, the curvature or density is 10 orders of magnitude less than the Planck density. And therefore, to convince cosmologists, somehow had to come up, convince cosmologists that, in fact, such effects can occur. We had to come up with some little reasoning as to why possible, basically. Because non-commutative geometry people also think that these effects will be suppressed. So I think it's good to come up with... I think there's work to be done, and I think it's fertile ground, so I think it's good.
More questions? Well, so I have a question. Gianluca, have you guys given any thought to what would happen if instead of working at the level of the constraints, one did the same construction at the level of the action? That is, you take your classical action, put these inverse volume corrections there and so on, and work it from there. Do you expect to get the same thing you have or something different?
Well, in standard inflation, of course, you can start with the Lagrangian formulation. And in fact, this is what the people mostly did. And if you do the same thing in the Hamiltonian formulation, you obtain the same result. However, I have no clue of what would happen here because these inverse volume corrections are basically motivated by the structure of the Hamiltonian constraint. And I don't know.
Yeah, but I mean, you could write the action in sort of Hamiltonian form, right? And
yeah, the issue would... Well, we didn't try. Maybe it can be done.
Okay.
But I don't know now what type of corrections you should put for instance, just in the scalar field action.
I mean, to some extent, this problem was tackled by Perum and Spanish collaborators, who I forget now the names, and Gonzalo Olmo. And so perhaps... But what they found was that the action was very, very complicated. It was not some simple thing. So maybe there's some guidance to be taken from there, and that's a possibility. Maybe Param has some comments on this.
In,
So in that work, like we didn't consider inverse scale factor corrections because I think like they do not have much meaning in the flat case. So that was k equal to zero work with holonomy modifications, and then it is certainly true that one can try to find an action. It is not really straightforward because of the subtlety is coming from extra degrees of freedom and so on. But like one can write down a infinite series action, and in which like the connection plays an equally fundamental role as the metric. But nobody has done this calculation for the inverse scale factor. So I think it's a good problem to work at for some students. Like they can just take the classical constraint, and they can just put the modified. One maybe can do this in the k equal to one model where inverse scale factors will be tied to the space-time curvature, and one can just replace wherever one sees inverse scale factor with the inverse eigenvalues as Thomas has given, and then I think one should try to do a legendary transform and write down an action.
More questions? Okay, let's thank Gianluca again.
You know,